All right, welcome to today's interview. We have a very special VIP guest today, Ed Dowd. You know him. He has been gracious enough to spend his time with us and other media outlets. He's done a lot of interviews. And his group, Finance Technologies, has put out a report. This was a couple of weeks ago, I believe. The Vaccine Damage Project, the Human Cost, where it is detailed the actual human and economic cost of the excess injuries, disabilities, and deaths that can be quite conservatively attributed to the vaccines. So, Mr. Dowd, you are doing extraordinary work. Humanity is blessed to have you here. Thank you for joining my show today.
Mike, so good to be here. I love talking to you anytime.
Well, it's probably overdue to have a conversation here, but we covered your report editorially. You want to run us through that briefly, what you were able to really document? And also my one comment is, I think your numbers are very conservative. The reality is probably much higher, but you can't necessarily document higher numbers. But tell us what you do have there at Finance Technologies.
Yeah, so you're right. We erred on the side of conservatism. And even with our conservatism, the numbers are shocking. And likely, like you said, much higher. So let's go through what we, so we started this project when I wrote the book. Carlos and Yuri, my two partners at Finance Technologies, helped me with the data collection that you found in Finding Cause Unknown. But, you know, this is a rolling fraud, and this required a tremendous amount of work. We now have two data scientists on board that are helping us. They have day jobs, so this is all volunteer work. We have a physicist who also has a day job who joined. We have two editors, myself. And so this has been, I just want to say, this has been a tremendous amount of work done by seriously credentialed people who don't want their good names sullied. So this is done with integrity, and we are investors first. So investors don't wait for the medical professions or the government authorities to tell us what we can surmise. So we think we have the analyst mosaic, and the vaccine damage report was kind of the closing phase of what we've discovered. And let me just go through it. So we conservatively calculated excess deaths. Let's go through the human cost first. Excess deaths, 300,000 conservatively from the vaccine. And that we added both up 21 and 22. It's likely higher. We estimate the economic cost for all of 22, just to make things simple, because the excess deaths is the lowest dollar amount. The disabilities are cumulative, so that's 1.36 million. And then we discovered we've been trying to quantify vaccine injury because we know there are some. And we discovered that with the BLS, U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, absence data and work time loss data. And it's horrendously a black swan event there. And we've estimated through the clinical analysis of the Pfizer trials they wanted to hide those from us for 75 years. So we took the adverse events that were going on while the trial was still live, and we calculated the number of injuries against all the doses given. And we came up with 26.6 million people injured. And how does that present itself? We believe that's presenting itself in its suppressed immune system, which is causing chronic sickness that presents a host of different disorders that, you know, you can't identify as a vaccine directly, but are caused by your suppressed immune system. So these people are getting sick.
Let me just interrupt you right there for a second. First of all, these are extraordinary numbers, 26.6 million individuals affected. And what I want to point out is one way that this translates into reality. So all of us, we try to conduct day-to-day business. You know, you try to call your banker or your doctor or your accountant or your parts supplier for your tractor or whatever. And I think we're all noticing over the last couple of years that, well, they're short-staffed. Why? Because their people are sick. They're sick. They're in the hospital. They're seriously ill. They're sick over and over again. So that's the kind of real-world translation of what you're talking about. These aren't just numbers on a sheet. This starts to slow down the entire economy, does it not?
Absolutely. And, you know, I when I saw these numbers last week, we dropped the report last Monday, and, you know, I got to be honest, like, I've been pretty good about keeping my spirits high, but this really... The amount of people that have been affected, I mean, deaths are bad and disabilities are bad, but this the buckets are not static. So the injured can become disabled and or dead. So these buckets are not like, oh, you're injured and you're fine. There's problems here. A suppressed immune system is a big deal. And I had a tough time last week, but I'm over it because, you know, I got to fight on. But it really kind of devastated us when we saw the numbers. And in fact, a little inside baseball, before the weekend before we released the report, one of our data scientists discovered an error. The error was to the upside. So we had 13.3 million injured. There was a calculation that was done wrong, and we doubled the number by fixing that. So we thought that was low, and then sure enough, we caught the error. So this is just devastating. And you're right, Mike. So what you're seeing in the real world, and we all experience it, is, you know, you go to a restaurant, they used to stay open until 10, they close at 8 because they don't have enough people
right
for the shifts. My car got into a little fender bender, couldn't get it. It's an Audi, and there's no Audi dealership on Maui, so I had a devil of a time trying to get a part or even a body shop to take it because they had so many cars already on their lot, they couldn't view it, so I had to do a photo estimate. And my insurance company finally decided that it was probably more beneficial to the insurance company to basically junk the car and sell it for parts. So that my blue book was 6. They told me that, and they gave me 10. So wow. insurance companies are not nice people. So they obviously made a profit giving me 10, stripping the car. They came, they sent it a tow truck, took my car out of the driveway. It was gone, and I'm sure they stripped it clean for parts. And this is what's going on, and the economy is slowly kind of just becoming defective. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, they stripped your car for parts. I feel like the economy is being stripped for parts, right? Every business is being stripped down and sold off for parts, and then it doesn't work synergistically like it used to, and we lose all these efficiencies and abundance factors, and we're all going to be poorer because of this.
Yeah, and you know, let's talk about productivity. We measured what we could. So when we go through the damage report, we're only analyzing what was lost in wages and salaries. What you can't get a good estimate for is, you know, the lost supply chain knock-on effects, the delays, the worker who is chronically getting sick but, you know, doesn't call in that sick that week. He's there or she's there, but they're working at 50% speed.
Exactly.
Or 75% speed. Then that causes the people who aren't sick to have to pick up the slack. Then they burn out. So, there's, you know, everyone's, and everyone who's not vaccinated that works in a place where they're heavily vaccinated know and feel burnt out because they're being relied upon to put in overtime, to take that shift. So this is a catastrophic effect on the economy. So let's run through the economic numbers now. And again, this is just from the national accounts, lost wages and salaries. So the deaths accounted for 5.2 billion. The disabilities accounted for approximately 52 billion, and the injuries is the largest number, lost work time, 89 billion. And you know, before we put out the vaccine damage report, we put out the absence and work time data report. And there, it's just alarming. The graphs there are basically like this. They go straight up like they're going to fold back on themselves. And what I mean by that is the slope is accelerating into 2022. So it went up a little bit in 2020, which makes sense. Absence rates and work time loss, because there was a lot of confusion. There were lockdowns. People, you know, so it went up. But it didn't break trend. Then it broke trend in 2021. A 20-year trend, and then in 2022 it went even higher, and 50% increase of lost work time over 2019, 50%. So this is a 13 standard deviation event in 2022 in lost work time. So the what's going on is we have a pandemic now. So the death numbers, the disabilities, and this lost work time suggest that we have a pandemic right now that they're not talking about because it's the vaccine. If we had these numbers during 2020, they would have been heralded and stamped all over the media. They're not being talked about or analyzed. We're the only ones doing it that I know of. And you know what's interesting? I think Wall Street's starting to pay attention to us because people are that are Wall Street professionals are now reaching out to me in mass. And it's starting to dawn on people something has gone off the rails.
Yeah, clearly. All right. So total economic cost just for 2022 is about $148 billion, according to the calculations at your report. And again, I want to tell people they can get it at Finance Technologies, and that's spelled P-H-I, financetechnologies.com is where they can find that report. Now, this is extraordinary for a number of reasons, because, of course, that's just 1 year. So 2023 numbers, perhaps in another year from now, you'll be able to calculate that.
Correct.
And those numbers might be larger because, as you said, these categories aren't fluid. Someone who's injured can become disabled and then be completely unable to work, or someone disabled may expire because of this. So have you given thought to the 10-year outlook of the economic damage caused by these vaccine mandates?
Well, so that's game theories would suggest if we stop it now, we can affect the outcome of what we're thinking. If
yes.
It doesn't stop, it gets worse. So my goal is to end the vaccination program, have them pulled, have a national discussion on what just happened so that people who are injured and getting sick don't go to the doctor and get treated for symptoms. They get treated for the underlying root cause, which is a suppressed immune system. So until people are aware of the problem, they can't fix it. So that's what we need to do. So if we don't stop this, let's just pretend that we carry on as is and people don't know what's ailing them. Colonel Theresa Long called me the day this report came out. And she said she's seeing exactly the three buckets that I'm talking about: deaths, disabilities, and injuries. And the injured pilots can't fly. So she said if we don't, between the vaccine debacle, the fact they can't recruit anymore due to the woke military culture, and the fact that they still people don't want to get vaccinated anymore. She said we won't have a standing army in 5 years at this rate.
Yeah, talk about real world impacts, and also munitions production. We've been shipping a lot of munitions to Ukraine, and the Pentagon leaders have been talking about a shortage of munitions, trying to ramp up factories in order to build more artillery rounds, for example. Well, guess what? You're going to need labor. You're going to need workers to show up and do the work. And you're killing the laborers right now. So I'm really glad you just mentioned that, Ed. I mean, how can we actually defend our nation, much less have a thriving economy, if we're killing the working class at rather alarming numbers here, or injuring them to the point where they can't be productive?
You know, Theresa Long said something interesting. She said during the Vietnam War, the strategy of the Viet Cong was not to kill a soldier, but to injure a soldier, because for every soldier injured, it disrupted the supply chain with five other people having to care for that person.
That's right.
So it slowed everything down. So let's take this analogy to our labor force right now. And I'm not saying this is the plan, but let's say you're a military and you wanted to take over the U.S. with infrastructure intact, and you wanted to wound the enemy so that they were distracted, and all their resources that would be geared up for war are now being put to taking care of a decimated labor force. I'm not saying that's the plan, but that if we don't stop this, someone could take advantage of that for sure. Someone could literally waltz in here in 5 to 10 years, and we wouldn't be able to put up a fight.
You know, there's another factor there, too. This was in headlines recently. Because of the COVID lockdowns, we now have 10,000 active duty military members who have moved into the obesity column, and they can no longer qualify on the fitness test to be active duty. So we have rampant obesity in the military, and then about 25% of the nation's youth cannot qualify to be recruited into the military because
Correct.
Of rampant obesity, which is tied to the lockdowns, lack of exercise, sedentary lifestyles, all these things. It's all related.
It is, and it's the impact is devastating. And, the vaccine project and the humanity project we did for the world because it needed to be done, but, we're investors. And so now, this research we just did, we applied to an economic report we just put out where we said the unemployment rate really isn't 3.6, it's 2.6%. Not because the labor market's tight, it's because the labor pool is shrinking due to death, disability, and injury. So what does that mean? That means the Fed, let's pretend the Fed doesn't know what's going on, they're going to look at the labor market And they're going to say the labor market's still tight. We can't lower interest rates, or they'll fight the market wanting them to lower interest rates. So they're going to get they could potentially be deceived by the stats they're looking at, not understanding that the labor force is much smaller than they believe it is, and the unemployment rate is actually lower due to that. And this could end up being a debacle of debacles if they don't start lowering interest rates soon, which they have to. The market wants them to.
Okay, you've just opened up a Pandora's box here. We got to jump into. So the next FOMC meeting, I believe, is the first week of May. The Fed is currently at I think, a 5% interbank lending rate, and considering a 25 basis point raise in early May, correct? You're saying that the Fed may be wildly miscalculating the labor pool availability, not factoring in what you just talked about, which is encompassed in your report. If the Fed miscalculates and they don't lower rates, they just pause and just hold it where we are, because I doubt they're going to raise, but they could. But if they pause or raise rates, isn't that going to inflict economic Armageddon on the banks like Silicon Valley Bank? We saw the same issue there with because they're holding the long-term debt, mortgage-backed securities and treasury debt that pays nothing or near nothing. And we have record withdrawals from banks across the country. I mean, if the Fed miscalculates, it could be devastating for the financial system.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, I'm not sure whether they're incompetent or it's a plan. It doesn't really matter at this point. My thought is this: the damage has already been done, so we have to pay the piper. We've predicted a recession as of November. We came out with a recession report. The new recession report we put out yesterday predicts an even more severe recession than we had previously thought in November. And so we're going to pay the piper. The question is, do they exacerbate the problem by holding rates high for too long? And I suspect they will do that, because they're going to look at the labor market, they're going to probably miscalculate, and it's going to cause a devastating effect in this country and globally. Because the market is already predicting the Fed is going to cut interest rates four times this year. So, and even if they do cut interest rates, it's not bullish by any measure. It just means that they're starting to signal to the markets that they're in an easing phase, and that easing phase won't generate itself into the economy until, you know, a year to 18 months later, because there's always a lag effect on policy. So their tightening from last year is hitting us now.
But I thought the Fed was committed to not pivoting this year throughout the whole calendar year.
Correct. But the market is saying the bond market is calling BS on that. So you get right. You get what the Fed says, and you get what the bond market thinks. Two different things.
Somewhere there's going to be a collision. Like, somebody's going to be wrong in this.
Correct. And the bond market was agreeing with them in their rate hike cycle until recently, because the economy is slowing drastically. Bank runs have begun, with Silicon Valley Bank being the first. And the math is just upside down. And the bond markets are figuring that out. And that's what's going on right now.
So we're seeing a lot of layoffs right now. Even McDonald's is laying off people. Amazon, the tech sector, real estate sector, massive layoffs. And when you look at the report that you put together at Finance Technologies about the human cost, do people realize that when you have a disability of inflicted upon a working person or a death, you're actually destroying decades of knowledge and know-how that allows these companies to function? And you lose that. And plus, on top of that, people are running out of spare money to buy, let's say, chicken McNuggets. You have a contraction. But this isn't just a simple cycle. You can't just reverse this and, oh, let's go back to expansion. These people and their knowledge, it's in the grave, man. You just can't resurrect that knowledge and plug it back into the system, right?
No, you can't. And so, yeah, again, these are the types of costs and productivity losses we can't measure. And they're multiples above the dollar figure I gave you. So we gave you a $150 billion estimate. It could be, you know, 2 to 10x that to a cost to the economy. And it's devastating. It's just absolutely devastating.
And the Fed's only answer to this, though, seems to be to print more money, because, you know, it seems to me they can't raise interest rates anymore without breaking the system. even though inflation, real inflation, is much higher than the current rate. So what are they going to do? Just print money and bail out everything and hope that works? Because it doesn't.
So what's interesting is people think they're printing money now. That's not what they did. So the Fed's balance sheet went back up, but that money is not quantitative easing that was printed and used to buy government bonds. What they did is they gave loans to banks against their underwater collateral to put their finger in the dike for so we had a liquidity issue with Silicon Valley Bank. All they've done is provided liquidity. These loans do not get translated into economic activity and credit creation. So that's important. So this money that they've lent to these banks is not getting into the system. So the credit contraction has been slowed, but not stopped. That's all they've done. This is just a stopgap measure. And I said publicly a couple of weeks ago on an interview that I believe that they know that the system's collapsing. So wouldn't you want to kind of slow it down and control it? And I believe the regional banks, a lot of them are going to disappear. We're going to be left with 6 mega banks. And that way you can introduce a central bank digital currency. And this is not conspiracy theory. People in hedge funds and around the world of economics and finance are seeing this. This likely happens. The regional banks are in trouble. They probably get bought or married to bigger banks, and they want to control that speed. If this thing goes fast and they lose control, then it's chaos, and that's not good for any of us.
Yeah, exactly. It seems to me that at every turn, what the Fed and the Treasury are doing is distorting the free market principles that encourage people to make rational decisions that ultimately reduce aggregate risk. So, for example, they're offering face value for these long-term securities that are currently discounted because of the low yields. So doesn't that encourage banks to make crazy decisions like, oh, I'll go out and buy from these other banks these low yield 10-year bonds, and then I'll just lend them to the Fed and get full face value? And it's like, well, so how is the bond market supposed to be, rationally approached at this point if face value doesn't mean face value and numbers are all magical? You know what I mean?
What these loans have done, I mean, these banks now have these loans, but they got to pay the Fed. So this hurts their profitability. And they know that this is a temporary, if they're smart, they know it's a temporary stopgap measure. So what they're doing is they're reducing their loans out to businesses that need, the lifeblood of credit. Uh-huh. And so they're going to slow down their new loans because they're worried about their deposit base eroding. So this is feeding on itself. So it's already begun. Credit is hard to get, and it's going to get tighter.
Yeah. Okay. So credit contraction kind of tells the story of where things are going. Let me ask you on a global scale now, kind of to shift gears. Let's talk about de-dollarization. Maybe this isn't something that you typically focus on, but I'm sure it's in your wheelhouse. We've seen a lot of activity recently, especially the Saudis and doing deals with China, Iran, Russia, and so on. Mexico interested in the BRICS nation systems. The Saudis are seemingly at war with either Joe Biden or the Federal Reserve, or maybe both, with the sharp reduction in oil output, a million barrels per day out of OPEC. Half of that from the Saudis alone, 500,000 barrels per day. What's your take on what's happening with the petrodollar status and BRICS nations and their possible global reserve currency attempt?
Well, I think it's an attempt. I think it's a lot of headlines. It's first of all, as American citizens, we don't want de-dollarization to occur because it's going to be devastating for us. So let's not root for the death of the dollar. But I'll give you my best guess. I actually still believe the dollar is trying to find a nice low. And then once the credit contraction goes in earnest and we start to see banks fail, the dollar will go straight up. And if we see a sovereign debt crisis, somebody big defaults like Japan or Italy or somebody, the dollar is going straight up. The system is mostly in dollars, $7 trillion in currency transactions a day, I believe. 90% of the other side of the trade is the dollar. So the dollar is still the primary currency. And you got to remember, a lot of these countries, Turkey just did a bond issuance, U.S. dollar denominated. So they're still using dollars. They're not going to use the Chinese or Russian ruble, whatever that may be. So they're still doing it. And there's $15 trillion in dollar denominated foreign debt. So the dollar system is fine. I think it's going to be fine for a while, but we certainly should be concerned that there's now an open discussion about it where there was none before. So it's not going to happen for a long, long time, but this is the beginning of the loss of the empire. I mean, these countries are no longer fearful of us to talk about this in the open. This would probably whispered in dark corners, and now they feel, you know, given the president we have and what's going on here, they feel like emboldened.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, we've never seen the Saudis act this way with any administration in the U.S. that I can remember. But let me ask you a different question. Central bank digital currencies, the FedNow program. Now, there are huge technical hurdles to actually implement such a system. But they're talking about it now. Do you think that that's something that they're actually going to attempt to implement nationwide by forcing or coercing people into digital wallets and ending the traditional banking system relationships of local banks and checking and savings account and all that? I mean, where do you think that's going?
So I think that's the end game. The system is out of oxygen and they need to replace it. So we've heard the Bank of International Settlements gentlemen talk about what they want to do with the central bank digital currency. It's total control. It's social control. It's a loss of freedom. I think the Fed knows that the system's changing and the Fed doesn't want to give up their power. So they're going to try to marshal everybody into the central bank digital currency. It's going to take time. It's not easy to do. It would be much easier if there are only six big systemically important banks left at the end of this. If I put on my game theory hat, how do you get people to beg for a new system? Things are collapsing and falling apart. So I suspect this gets introduced, or they attempt to introduce it, at the nadir of our economic pain, when stock markets are much lower than they are now, when there's lots of joblessness despite the vaccine injuries, when there's unrest going on in other countries, when the headlines are at their most fearful, they're going to have a solution for us. And that's when people will beg for it. I mean, you want to implement a system that's evil, you get people to beg for it.
Yeah, it seems like a universal basic income, but you can only get the free money if you sign up and use this system. That's going to be very convincing for a lot of people. Oh, free money? I just have to join this wallet system and, you know, give up anonymity of all my other money? Fine. For some people who just need to be able to afford the highly inflated groceries, that's going to be their survival strategy, I would think.
Yeah. And again, you know, Carlos Urie and I, the founding partners, you know, we don't exactly know what's going to happen, but we're trying to, you know, the report we put out yesterday, we talked about the different flavors of recession. So we're trying to, you know, understand that it's a dynamic process. If we go systemically into a crisis in the next 2 months, the Fed will react. What is the Fed's reaction? So we're kind of wargaming this, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we do know the system is in its end days, and we do know an economic recession is coming. With those two things, usually asset prices go lower. You know, the Fed is not going to be able to bail out asset prices this time.
Well, they may try. Maybe the plunge protection team will take some steroids and print and buy like mad to try to stop it.
They'll try, Mike, but the political will for the Fed to do what they need to do to save the next downturn. And I believe you'll see calls for the Fed to buy stocks. They're not allowed to buy stocks currently.
Right.
I'm going to make a bold prediction. The next 2 or 3 years, people will beg the Fed to buy equities to help shore up the financial system.
So if that happens, that's the end of a rational market.
That's the end. Well, that's the end. We live in a feudalistic system where the central bank owns the companies, or at least parts of the company, you know, a certain percentage of the companies. A corporate CEO is now a feudal lord, and that's it. It's the end game. It's the ownership, a bank's ownership of the economy. And so it's a top down dictatorial, tyrannical leaders, not, you know, let's say wet dream.
right. Okay. Horrifying scenario, but there's one more horrifying scenario. Let me run this by you. Have you heard whispers of the discussions of blaming consumers for the Silicon Valley Bank runs and saying that it's consumer behavior, i.e. Too many people too rapidly freaking out and sharing messages on their iPhones and then pulling their money out too quickly, causing that bank to collapse or have a liquidity crisis technically. So the consumer is being blamed or the customer is being blamed, and then whispers of rumors that in order to alleviate this, they must instigate delays on withdrawals or daily withdrawal limits across the banking system. Have you heard any of this, or do you think that's even possible for them to consider doing?
Well, I don't put it past them, but I heard the same rumors that they were trying to float the idea of blaming the consumer. Let's be honest here. Silicon Valley Bank. So let me tell you what happened with Silicon Valley Bank in reality. So Silicon Valley Bank is heavily involved in the tech sector, the VC community, venture capital. Venture capitalists get their money from pension funds. They have billions and billions of dollars, and their inflows were quite good. Silicon Valley Bank was experiencing great growth in deposits because the venture capitalists told their new startup companies that they invested in, let's say you gave a check for a round one to a new company of $10 million. They told this company you needed to bank with Silicon Valley Bank. They gave them great banking terms, but you had to keep all of your money, that $10 million at Silicon Valley Bank. And Silicon Valley Bank loved that because they got, they're paying zero on that money or close to zero, and then lending out and making what's called a net interest spread. And so that's great business. As long as the deposits were growing and they were buying more assets, deposits versus, which are liabilities versus assets, it was a great business. Well, their growth in deposits hit a tailwind in January, February of 2022, the tech stock market and the economy started rolling over. And one of the first places where funding dried up was in the internet startup game. So the VCs weren't getting any new money invested. The companies, when they get more money, they're able to fund more companies. So what happened was all of a sudden the deposits stopped growing. And these companies, though, that aren't profitable, had to withdraw the money from Silicon Valley Bank for operating costs. So slowly over 2022, the deposits started to flow out ever so gently. And I think the VCs started to, so they had an asset liability mismatch. At one point, their deposits started to probably accelerate downwards as operating costs started to accelerate or companies were shut down, startup companies, that is. And the VCs are the ones who caused the bank run. It's been well documented that they pulled out billions of dollars before everybody else. Then the public was alerted to it. So this idea that the consumer was responsible for spreading bank failure rumors is nonsense. In fact, it came to my attention that there was a think tank that had some CIA individuals were starting to float stories about me causing the bank run, or me and others. That didn't go anywhere because what's funny is I was working so hard on the vaccine issue. My first tweet on Silicon Valley Bank was the day. The Friday that the Fed took over. So how did I cause a bank run without talking about it? So
the idea that the markets are so fragile or that bank liquidity is so fragile that two or three guys by just talking about it can crash the entire system. Well, that's an admission of the fragility of the entire system right there, if that were the case.
Well, let's say I'm the one who caused it, which isn't true. My defense would be, boy, your system's really just awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a dude that wrote a book on vaccine damage. I make a comment about a potential crisis coming, and you're blaming it on me. Gee, thanks. I'll take the notoriety, but it's not that simple. There was big withdrawals by big VCs that caused the run. It was big rich people that caused the run, not the tiny consumer.
Right, but you're pointing out something that's really critical, I think, for us to understand is that we live in a time of increasing authoritarianism and censorship, where the powers that be say that you're not allowed to say certain things. You're not. Oh, wow, we're getting some hail here, by the way.
So, God is talking to us, I think, right now.
Yeah, but I shall continue. So you're not allowed. I mean, it could come up in the future where you're not allowed to say to sell any stock because they would say, well, that might cause that stock to crash or the stock market to crash. the system becomes so overbought and so fragile that you're only allowed to put money in or buy in or even in banks. You can deposit, but not withdraw, because withdrawal, that's an act of financial terrorism, you see. Ed, I know we're about to wrap this up anyway, and now we're having crazy weather here, so a lot of noise on my side, I apologize, but thank you, Ed, for your insight. I think you're brilliant. I think you're courageous. How can people support your work, by the way?
If you want to support me temporarily, you can buy my book. That'll help a little bit, Cause Unknown. That's for your loved ones who think we're crazy. But Finance Technologies, we'd love for you to use and multiply the knowledge transfer to your lawmakers, to your congressmen, to your school boards, to your employers, to the hospitals. We want people to take this knowledge and use it.
Well, you're certainly doing that. People are taking your knowledge and using it. And I want to encourage everybody to visit your website, financetechnologies.com. That's spelled with a P-H-I. Finance, P-H-I, technologies. And thank you, Ed, for all that you do and for spending time with us today. We'd love to have you back when you've got more data to announce. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Have a great one, Mike. Thank you.
All right. You too, Ed. And thank all of you for watching. Feel free to share this video on any platform, any channel. Give credit to Ed Dowd at Finance Technologies. And be mindful of what's coming. This knowledge can help save you and save your finances. Take it seriously. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon.com, the free speech platform. Thank you for watching today. God bless you all. Take care. Today's interview is brought to you by HealthRangerStore.com. And I'm always excited to talk about all the different solutions we have for personal health. Today, check this out. We have black cumin seed oil here, which is really potent. It's just an amazing product. And it tastes great, unlike a lot of black cumin seed oil products. This one actually has a very nice taste. Check it out. In fact, if you go to the website, healthrangerstore.com, I've got that page up here. You can see you can buy a six pack of this if you wish, or you can buy it in smaller quantities. You get the full description and the ingredients here and some of the ways that it supports your natural body functions as well. So check all that out at healthrangerstore.com. We've also got here an amazing instant coffee. This is really delicious. It's a great barter item. And of course, it's fair trade coffee. Of course, as you know, we test all our products for heavy metals and glyphosate and microbiology and much more. Did you know that coffee can often have high cadmium in it? It's true. In fact, cadmium is one of the things that gives coffee its kick. Yeah, I know it's crazy, but actually ingesting cadmium can make you feel temporarily energized, even though it's poisoning your system. The same thing is true about mercury, by the way. Interesting history about toxic elements. But we run all the tests in our mass spec laboratory, ISO accredited, audited, inspected, and this is all certified organic, of course. So lab tested plus organic plus fair trade, instant freeze-dried coffee. You can get it right now at healthrangerstore.com. Here's a three-pack. You can get it, or you can get single packs if you want, or we have number 10 cans of this as well, as you can see here on the right. So a great barter item. It's also just really delicious and really portable. And we thank you for your support. Again, healthrangerstore.com.